Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. We've got a very exciting show today. First of all, we have some disturbing information, though, about highway safety in California and the state of our infrastructure. We also have news about a turkey bacon recall. And then we have a very special interview today for you Charger fans out there with the Bolt Man, otherwise known as Jan Jeregi. He has a theory about the city being able to sue the NFL for antitrust violations to keep the Chargers in town. And immediately after that interview, we've also got on the phone from New York City, James Quinn, an antitrust lawyer who has sued the NFL in the past and has a winning track record. We also have an interview today with the owner of East County's newest brewery, Pacific Islanders Beer Company, talking about what it takes to start a craft brewing company in San Diego, where this is a fast-growing industry gaining national acclaim. So stay tuned for these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Show, where East County matters. California highways have $57 billion in deferred maintenance, and our state now ranks 45th out of 50 states in overall highway performance. Over half of our state's highways need rehabilitation, and 28% of the state's bridges need repairs or replacement. But there is not enough money available to solve these problems, which are getting worse as time goes by. Those are among the dismal facts presented at a Caltrans Forum on Transportation Issues in San Diego last week. Potential solutions include charging drivers a per-mile charge, with those who drive more paying the lion's share. Raising the gas tax is another option, though that has been tried previously and failed. Reporting San Diego covered the forum in a two-part series that you can read at reportingsandiego.com. Local transportation issues were also discussed at the Caltrans Forum, including the new Otay Mesa East border crossing, a toll crossing set to open in 2018 and connect up to State Route 11 and from there, 125. A conspicuous absence was any discussion of highway delays or potential improvements along State Routes 94 and 67, despite many accidents and closures that have prompted recent complaints from residents. Transit enhancements are expected to occur in El Cajon and Santee, but not points further east due to lack of demand, according to Reporting San Diego. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Tasha Matthews with East County Magazine. Kraft Heinz Food Company is recalling more than 2 million pounds of turkey bacon products that may be adulterated because it was spoiled before the best when used date, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Food and Safety and Inspection Services announced. The company has received reports of illness related to the consumption of these products. Anyone concerned about an injury or illness should contact a healthcare provider. The following products are subject to recall: Oscar Mayer Select Uncured Turkey Bacon, and Oscar Mayer Turkey Bacon Smoked Cured Turkey Chopped and Formed. This problem was discovered by an establishment during an investigation into spoilage-related consumer complaints. When available, the retail distribution list will be posted on the United States Department of Agriculture, Food Safety, and Inspection Services website under Recall and Public Health Alerts. Consumers with questions about the recall can contact the Kraft Heinz Consumers Relations Center at 800-278-3403.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Ed Beretta. I'm here on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, recording at our studio at the East County Wellness Center. And today, my very special guest is Dan Jeregi, a.k.a. the Bolt Man. And we're here to talk on the stadium issue and a potential antitrust lawsuit that Chargers fans are asking the city to file against the NFL. Dan, thanks for coming. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on board.
We want to get to know you a little bit, Dan. Why don't you tell us a little bit how you became the Bolt Man and why you choose to don the costume and get out there and root on your team?
You know, the history with Bolt Man, initially it started back in 95 when the Chargers went to the Super Bowl, and that's when Boltman evolved. And the character's taken a different form throughout the years. You know, it's been, what, 95, and here we are in 2015. And some of the fans, season ticket holders back in 95 and 96 probably remember the older character on the field. It was a full body pod. And then, like I said, the transition as he's evolved has changed, and now he looks like what he does today. And a lot of reasons for the changes, the mobility, visibility. I mean, the list goes on. But yeah, it's something that I truly enjoy doing as a passion. I'm a passionate Charger fan, you know, born and raised here in San Diego. And, you know, I'm really committed to supporting our San Diego Chargers. We all have a love for our Chargers as fans, and I don't put myself above anybody. Yeah, my suit's a little more elaborate than some of the fans wear at a game, but, you know, we're all in the same playing field, and I don't put myself above anybody else. And I don't claim to be the mascot for the Chargers. However, I was at one time. I just enjoy doing it as a fan and getting out there and supporting our team and just, you know, try to create an energy and an excitement in the stadium during games and try to create a noise level to help our Chargers out in the field.
Yeah, so I was going to say that I really love the costume. The look of the costume is really awesome. Yeah, I think the fans need something like that in San Diego. I mean, we had a chicken for a while. That, you know, that's pretty cool. But yeah, the Boltman definitely is the way to go. Yeah, I think that it's important for fans to get excited about their local sports teams because San Diego is sort of a tough market. We have so much stuff we can go do, go to the beach, those kind of things. So having someone like you, I think, is important. And I'm glad that, you know, you have that humble approach to it. It's really all about the team, right? About the game, about winning that game and helping the team out by making that noise. So we appreciate you, Boltman. Thank you for coming in. So the current environment in the NFL seems to be a team can basically hold a city somewhat hostage, some would say. That might be an extreme term, but the city sort of has their hands tied while the football team decides what they want to do, where they want to go, and there's not much that us as fans can do.
Well, yeah, this is a really complicated issue. The dynamics involved here, there's a lot of moving parts, and the fans can't be tuned into everything that's going on, but it's literally been a emotional roller coaster ride with, I would say, more lows and highs. To put it in perspective, you know, when this was first announced in January and it came from Carson, not from the owners here in San Diego, you know, with a press conference, letting the Charger fans know in San Diego that, you know, that it's strictly a business move. And I think the majority of the Charger fans probably would have, you know, obviously been on board that the Chargers are basically making a decision here. If things don't work out in San Diego, that, you know, their option is to move to LA, you know, for the business and for what's best for the Chargers. I think most fans would have been on board and backed the owners up and doing that. But the way that it came out was they didn't do a press conference. It was a bad PR move on Mark Fabiani and Dean Spanos as the owner to have the city of Carson announce it. And now Charger fans are like, what? You know, what's going on? It's kind of like your spouse cheating on you down the street with your worst enemy and you find out from your friends, you know, it's not a good feeling. So definitely. I think we all know the history from there in the last 8 months, what has taken place. And it just seems that the NFL and the Chargers are making every effort possible to move to Carson. Or, you know, who knows? It could be Inglewood. And last minute, you know, it could be that the Chargers team up with the Rams in Inglewood. So there's a lot of dynamics involved here, a lot of moving pieces, and no one really knows what's going to happen. But as fans, we're going to make a stand. So that's why we're initiating demand letters to our city attorney.
You sent a demand letter on June 18th. To Jan Goldsmith, the city attorney, requesting an antitrust lawsuit for abuse of monopoly power on the part of the Chargers owners. Is that correct?
Well, correct. It would be the lawsuit would be filed against the NFL for abuse of monopoly power. Now, okay. Some people would say, well, what's an antitrust lawsuit? And to put it in layman's terms, what it is these laws were created back in like 1890. The Sherman Antitrust Act is laws that were created to protect the consumers from big corporations, from keeping the markets fair and balanced. So when you have these corporations that are abusing the system, there's nothing wrong with monopoly. But when you abuse a monopoly, and in the case with the Chargers and the NFL, there's 32 teams. So they can monopolize the 32 teams on where they will play in what cities. And so when there's only 32 teams, everybody wants a team in their state or even in their city. So when a team like the Chargers in the NFL are using Carson as leverage and they're putting all kinds of obstacles in the way when the city of San Diego is making best efforts to keep the Chargers here, those obstacles that the Chargers in the NFL are putting on the city of San Diego, those trigger the antitrust lawsuit.
Okay.
And someone would say, well, what are the Chargers doing? Right? I mean,
yeah,
they're going to say,
yeah,
well, what are the Chargers doing that's violating antitrust?
What exactly is it that's violating the trust?
Okay. So if you were to play devil's advocate and you were to say, okay, what is the city doing and what is the Chargers doing to come to best efforts to negotiate to get a deal done so that they can comply with the NFL bylaws in their constitution? Because they do have bylaws on relocation. There's an Article 8.5 and an Article 4.3. You can Google NFL relocation bylaws and it'll state in there what the NFL and their teams are, and their club members are supposed to do and moving forward with relocation. You know, they have to make best efforts to come to the city that they're playing in and negotiate in good faith. Now, if you were to be the devil's advocate and you're wanting to say, well, okay, what has the city of San Diego done so far? Well, you could start with they put the mayor since January has done more than what the city of San Diego has done in 14 years. I think we all agreed there. Yeah. Mayor Kevin Faulkner. He's done an awesome job in spearheading this. Now he put together a task force, the city, with some key players, some intelligent people that are talented. Jim Stieg, one of the heavy players.
City Stadium Advocacy Group, right?
Yeah. CSAG.
CSAG.
That's yeah. And, the mayor put a great team, a 9-member team. And like I said, Jim Stieg, one of the key players in there that has a tremendous amount of experience with Super Bowls, and the Super Bowls are what they are today, because he plays a big role in how they've evolved. So you have a city that has put a stadium group together. They put a finance plan together. They met all the requests that the NFL and the Chargers, including this new environmental impact report.
Right, which Mark Fabiani, who is a Chargers spokesman, he's been claiming that it's very unlikely to pass the legal standards for an environmental impact report. Have they really looked at it? Or should they be making those kind of statements before? It sounds like they're sort of muddying the waters with statements like that.
These are just obstacles that they're almost standard that Mark Fabiani makes. You know, anything that the city puts out there, Mark Fabiani is just going to just be chopped up and throw obstacles in it, make it more difficult for the city. But the city's confident that this EIR report, environmental impact report, will have teeth in it. And even if it gets challenged, they're confident. They spent, $2.1 million in 3 weeks, and they had over 200 people working on this 24/7. The city's confident with this EIR report. So when you have the city that's done all these things, including the finance plan and...
We've obviously engaged. The city of San Diego has engaged.
Absolutely.
Into the negotiating process, and it seems that the Chargers have been reluctant to do so.
Correct. I mean, and then the latest is that you have a special election now that'll be held in January 12th or 15th, which is critical. So the city of San Diego has clearly made best efforts to lay down the foundation of keeping the Chargers in San Diego, and they made best efforts. There's no question there. Now, for the Chargers, you know, in their defense, they're probably going to say, well, look at, you know, we've been at it for 14 years. Okay, and they keep using that. Mark Fabiani's favorite quote is, you know, we've been at it for 14 years. But the fans can sit there and throw numbers and say, well, look, you haven't taken us to a Super Bowl in over 20, and you lost it. So, but you know what? As Charger fans, we don't care. We love our Chargers to winning and losing seasons. Our allegiance is to our team, and we support them. But we're not throwing numbers out. So if you want to throw numbers out, you know, be a little more tactical. But, yeah. So
tell us a little bit about, in order for the team to move, they're supposed to show that they've encountered hardship in their current market. Talk a little bit about that.
Correct. Yeah. An NFL team, there's bylaws to the NFL on relocating. And those bylaws, the NFL Constitution clearly states that the team must have diligently engaged in good faith efforts to obtain and maintain suitable stadium facilities in their home territories in order to qualify for relocation. Now, this clearly hasn't happened. And when you read the articles, they really go into detail. There has to be hardship. Well, the San Diego Chargers, their history in the past 15 years to date, they started off at about $131 million in 2001. And today, well, last season, it was $262 million that the team has clearly made and profited.
So they literally doubled their profits.
I mean, the Chargers are ranked right in the middle out of the 32 teams as far as compatibility. So they would have a weak case proving that that they're having a hardship. And then one would say, well, what has Dean Spanos and Mark Fabiani, his point man for negotiating with the city of San Diego. What have they done? If you ask anybody, they would probably say nothing. Because there's the Chargers, the owners, have done nothing to stay in San Diego other than create these roadblocks. But one would say, well, what have they done in Carson? Well, we could start with the purchase, 11 acres for $22 million. The Chargers spearheading the signature drive to avoid the ERR report, which they were successful. That cost them $500,000 to do that. Then they hire Carmen Policy, an NFL executive that has experience in negotiating. So they bring him as an expert consultant. Numerous meetings with the mayor and city officials, all Dean Spanos's efforts are all in Carson. And, and Dean is obviously working side by side with Carmen Policy. Mark Fabiani's handling San Diego. So he'll just continue to throw dirt here and they build, you know, their potential location in Carson.
So yeah, it seems like really what the NFL is trying to do is get the most money for their products. And so, I mean, even to the point where Eric Gruben, the NFL executive vice president, his Twitter handle is Eric NFL Money. And that, I mean, that's just sort of a microcosm for everything that's going on. Some business people might say, well, you know, the Chargers are a business. They have the right to go make money. But what you're saying here is that we've got this constitution in place from the NFL, their own bylaws that are being violated. So now you've actually been consulting with a law firm out of New York that's had some antitrust lawsuits against the NFL in the past and been successful. This law firm, Weil, Gotshal and Manges, and attorney Jim Quinn, who is going to be talking to our editor Miriam Raftery shortly after this interview. And they're going to get more into the sort of legal side of the discussion. But tell us a little bit about where that's headed and why you consulted with this particular law firm.
Initially, I was just thinking, you know, is this legal, what the Chargers are doing? I mean, I should say the owners, you know, holding the city of San Diego hostage, extorting is really what it is, extorting and holding us hostage. One would think, well, the only thing missing here is a gun, because this is really what's happening. Wow. So I thought, well, this can't be legal. So as I started researching, I started looking into civil cases and ran into the antitrust NFL cases and then realized that there was a little bit of a similarity here to what took place in other antitrust lawsuits with the NFL by this law firm. So I reached out to him and was fortunate to have a good conversation with him. And, you know, we've been going back and forth. You know, I sent him information. He's requested lease agreements, the minutes involved with the lease agreement that was signed back in 2006. Because when this statement came out that we were demanding the city to file a lawsuit, the Chargers' response was that the Chargers were excluded from any lawsuits based on their 2006 lease agreement. Apparently, when the city signed that lease agreement back in 2006, it does not prevent them from suing now in 2015 because under the law, including the U.S. Supreme Court precedent, a party cannot waive future unknown antitrust claims because it's against public policy. Otherwise, an antitrust victim would be powerless to sue about something that they didn't know about in the future. So the Chargers' only defense when an antitrust lawsuit was brought up was based on their 2006 lease agreement. And of course, you know, Jim responded back with the statement I just made.
So Jan Goldsmith said that they weren't going to be pursuing that because of the 2006 lease agreement. But what you found in your research and consulting with this firm is that basically that's not true, that's invalid to try to write something like that into a lease agreement.
Correct. And, you know, that information from the attorney Jim Quinn was forwarded to Jan Goldsmith. Now, originally Jan was saying, yes, that it's true the 2006 lease agreement was an absolute waiver for the Chargers for any antitrust lawsuit. But I believe, you know, now that he's being interviewed, you know, he's kind of changing the tone a little bit, saying that what the city would rather do right now is negotiate than litigate. So it would seem that now he might be in favor of an antitrust lawsuit if the Chargers fail to come to the table, which is something that I feel that the city of San Diego is in a position today, and Jim would verify this, that they can file that injunction and force the Chargers to come to the table and negotiate. Now, the injunction would be filed against the NFL. The last thing the NFL is going to want to do is be involved with litigation on an antitrust violation, because what would happen initially is if the city of San Diego were to prevail in a case like this, this would change the future of how NFL teams relocate. And it could cost billions of dollars. This is a billion-dollar industry. I mean, they're at the $9 billion this year alone. They're expected to be at $18 billion in 4 years. So this could change the history of how teams relocate if the city were to file an antitrust lawsuit. Now, for owners, 3-5 years from now, everybody's going to want to throw their towel in the ring and saying, hey, you know what? The stadium is not competing with the LA stadium that the Chargers got. So we're going to hold our city hostage, and it just continues and continues, and it's a revolving wheel.
Yeah, it seems like every city that has a football team is going to be facing a new stadium issue because of the way that the current atmosphere is. So I think if something can be done in this situation, perhaps it'll help with future franchises trying to do the same type of maneuver where they're sort of leave their city high and dry looking for the best market for their bottom line. And that seems like that's sort of unethical because – really, sports is about love for your team. And when you get these fans involved to the level, you know, you have the blood drives and you have all this community involvement, and then just to split, it's really not cool. Yeah. And it's happened to many, many franchises. I know as a child, I grew up in Orange County and we lost the Rams, and it was, you know, no more rooting for the Rams. And I feel like the ownership is sort of arrogant in their assumption that people are just going to root for them in LA and they're going to have all this, a lot more money available to them, when the reality is the people that really love them are going to be hurt deeply. And, it's going to take a while for that to build up again up in LA. I don't think they're going to just waltz in there and, you know, this whole thing's going to go real smooth for them. I think that they might be assuming a lot, and to the point where Fabiani has even basically said that this, idea of the antitrust lawsuit is a joke. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, you're going to get the legal interpretation from Jim Quinn. And I think that once you understand, the way he would explain it, no, it's not a joke and the fans aren't joking.
So, Dan, let's say that the Chargers did up and leave town, and that would sort of put a halt on the stadium building process. How do you think that would impact the Aztecs and other events that use the stadium?
Well, yeah, the Aztecs will definitely be affected by it. I mean, you have the Poinsettia Bowl, the Holiday Bowl, the Aztecs play there. I mean, where would the Aztecs play if the Chargers leave? You know, if the stadium's costing $11 million a year for upkeep, I don't believe that the Aztecs have that in their budget. So, yeah, that would be a huge blow for our local Aztecs. Where would they play? It's a good question to bring up.
Yeah, there's really no other facility in the city that would be able to handle, 10,000-20,000 people like the Aztecs bring on any given Saturday. Mm. So it's sort of another good reason to keep them in town. I think people need to climb on board this issue a little bit more. People are hesitant to engage.
Yeah, the Aztecs, they play a huge role. That's a good question. Where would the Aztecs play if the Chargers were to leave? Because I don't believe the city's going to put $1.1 million stadium for the Aztecs to play. So the Aztecs would have to find a place to play. And, the Poinsettia Bowl and the Holiday Bowl, those were gone. Where else, move those. That's been tradition here in San Diego for years.
I don't think we want to see Aztecs playing at Helix High School.
No. No, that wouldn't work. That wouldn't work. No. You know, the Chargers, they play a big role in San Diego. I mean, they provide entertainment, civic pride. They generate a lot of jobs, revenue, college bowls. The Aztecs play there. We might have to focus that this is not just a stadium for the Chargers. This is going to be a multi-use stadium. So we could use it for a lot of things. It'll be used year-round. And that's something that we're going to really have to focus on the taxpayers for San Diego, that they're going to benefit from it. We're the eighth largest city. San Diego without a football team, it could be a ghost town. And most people probably don't realize the impact economically that is going to hit San Diego when the team leaves. So hopefully, we can get, voters on board to get this thing approved. And by January, I think it was 12th, which is a critical date as well.
And that's going to be a vote basically within the city limits, not within countywide, not a countywide vote, correct?
Correct, yeah. And that date, really, it's not set in stone, because the city of San Diego has given the Chargers or the NFL till September 11th. To come to the table and negotiate, because they have to get this EIR report submitted. There's timelines, for it to be challenged. There's a lot of political things involved and a process to getting the EIR report submitted, getting a initiative to have a vote in 2016, January. So the longer the Chargers take to come to the table, which is in the Chargers' favor. Obviously, this is it's probably their strategy is to prolong it so that by January, because the NFL is talking about bringing the date for relocation sometime in January. So obviously, in the Chargers' favor, they would rather have the NFL select the San Diego Chargers to move to LA, and then you know they can say, well, the city wasn't prepared with their I report, and they didn't get a ballot measure done for a special election on the date that they said. So the deadline that the city of San Diego get the Chargers. Really, it's a good move because it brings the Chargers to the table and it gets the ballot measure to be to set for that January 12th or 15th. What's going to happen if the Chargers don't come to the table? I don't believe they will because it's in their best interest not to show up to the negotiating table and prolong it so that the NFL can move them. I think that's really the strategy here.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lot of maneuvering that's been going on and leveraging and things like that. You know, it seems like the city of San Diego has less leverage than the Chargers do right now, which this is sort of this movement to bring this antitrust lawsuit would definitely give the city a lot more leverage.
You know, it would. Right now, they don't have anything. If the city were to at least, consider consulting with this law firm, you know, send a demand letter to the NFL saying, hey, here's your options. By September 11th, on or before that date, if the Chargers fail to come to the table, then we'll be forced to file an antitrust violations against the NFL and file the injunction. And that immediately, an injunction would have to be approved by a judge. The odds of that happening are pretty good because it's not a frivolous lawsuit. There's a lot of good arguments in the complaint, as we talked about earlier. And more than likely, a judge will honor an injunction. Well, that's going to be another delay of 6 months to discovery so that the Chargers can build their case, which they don't really have much in their defense other than the 14 years. And I've already went over what the city has done in good faith. So that injunction would probably be honored, and it would be a permanent injunction, and then it would go to court. And it could take 2 years, even in a fast track. You know, that this would definitely delay the Chargers moving to L.A., and it definitely throws a monkey wrench in it. And I'm just surprised that the city attorney's not taking advantage of it, and maybe he will. Maybe now that he's seen that the strength that this idea as a legal loophole keeping the Chargers here, maybe the city might look at it and take it more serious and reach out to the law firm.
Yeah, and you know, there's also been some other talk about bringing in the Raiders as leverage into our negotiations in the city of San Diego's side, like working with Mark Davis. I saw on a blog about that. And there's also talk of maybe trying to retain the name in San Diego so that if the Chargers left, they might take on a new name in L.A. We have to appreciate what we have here in San Diego because obviously L.A. is fighting hard to get a football team. There's a reason for that. They're not just willy-nilly wanting a football team. They want that revenue in-house in L.A. And the San Diego people may regret it if they let that go, and it might be too late. So as far as where we stand today, I see you guys just a few days ago, August 18th, sent a letter to Commissioner Goodell and also Anastasia Denius, the NFL's chief litigation officer. And if I could just quote from this letter real quick, it says, "Unless the NFL and the Chargers come to the table for meaningful good faith negotiations on staying in San Diego County, we will launch an initiative to have the city retain a team of experienced sports antitrust lawyers, starting with the law office of Weil, Gottschall & Manges LLP, to stop the move. This will be another legal black eye for the league in a growing list of legal problems with the start of the 2015 season," unquote. So have you heard back from the NFL?
We haven't heard back, no.
Okay, and it's been a few days. You'd think that they would want to respond to something like this. It's a potential lawsuit about antitrust violations. That should be a big deal to them. That silence maybe says something.
Well, yeah, I think it admits that, you know, that they have some serious problems coming. And, you know, we did receive a receipt that they received it. So we know they received it. Maybe for them, no answer is a good answer or response. But I think the letter, the way it was written and structured, was everything we talked about. All the violations, how the city's, you know, coming to the table with good faith negotiations, the Chargers are failing. And the NFL, they're part of it. They play a big role, you know. And real quick, wrapping this thing up, is that when Eric Grubin came to San Diego, he's the VP executive for the NFL, he laid down the ground rules for the Chargers, saying that if there were going to be any potential for the Chargers to stay in San Diego, that the city would really have to make efforts in producing a special election. They had requested it in 2015, but obviously that wasn't going to happen. So they wanted a special election in 2015. In addition to that, they wanted The Chargers wanted the finance plan not to have any mixed development around the stadium, which is unfair because that's how their, you know, the original CSAC plan had $250 million.
Yeah.
So I think they did that on purpose. In addition to that, they had requested that the Chargers keep any PSL or naming rights, the personal seat licenses, the PSL, and any naming rights to the stadium. All those revenues would go to the Chargers. So it really put the city of San Diego in a position where it was hard to, you know, to try to counter that, but they went ahead and did it anyway. So the new plan now is, you know, they would generate this cash flow through revenue bonds, you know, possibly selling the sports arena. But either way, the Chargers removed that $250 million from the mixed development around the queue, and they're going to come up with ways of doing it. They've said they do it, and I believe they will. They, you know, they're very confident about where they're going to get these revenues from, whether they're bonds, and the EIR report, getting it completed in the timeline that the NFL and the Chargers are requested.
So from your standpoint, you think the city has a good position to bring the Chargers to the table, and that basically this potential antitrust lawsuit would be extra guarantee that they'll come in and talk to the city.
Well, we're hoping that the demand letter that was sent will send shockwaves to the NFL and saying, hey, look, you know, we're serious here. San Diego's very serious, and so is our Charger fans. And there needs to be good efforts, and it's probably in their best interest for the NFL to bring the Chargers back to the negotiating table and do it within the timeline, not to purposely delay it longer than the September 11th deadline, because obviously that's going to benefit the Chargers if they can continue to delay that. You know, if I was a betting man right now, I would say the Chargers aren't coming to the table on September 11th, because we know that what their motive is to delay it. And then, you know, there won't be no time for a special election. And then they're going to say, well, we tried and you guys didn't do your job at the timeline that we requested. But how can they say that when they're not coming to the table? So really, it'll backfire on the NFL and the Chargers.
Well, hopefully we can retain the team in San Diego, because I am a Charger fan. So on behalf of Charger fans, I want to thank you, Dan, for taking on this role. I know it's not easy. You're taking on the beast. So I really appreciate you coming down, and we'll look for Boltman to be out at the games this season.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm looking forward to just focus on the game and the regular season, and just, you know, get away from the politics and all the legal stuff.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Once again, on East County Magazine, this has been Ed Barena with Dan Jaregi, a.k.a. the Boltman.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Now, we've just been speaking with the Boltman, and now we have on the phone from New York City, James Quinn with the law office of Weil, Gottschall, and Manges. He is an attorney who has sued the NFL many times, and he has a winning track record. And he's here to tell us all about the case against the Chargers and the NFL. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Now, we've been speaking with the Boltman, Dan Jaregi, and he believes that the Chargers are violating both the NFL charter and the Sherman Antitrust Act. As an attorney with expertise in this area, do you agree with him, and if so, why?
The antitrust laws are an effort to ensure that there's competition among different competitors. Here the competitors are NFL owners, and the competition is for where the franchises would be placed. And in this instance, the NFL, at least on its face, owners have gotten together and decided that, as a group, that they're going to encourage the Chargers to leave San Diego and to move to Los Angeles. And that raises serious antitrust issues.
Okay. You were known for suing the NFL successfully and winning, including a landmark case that gave players the right to become free agents after a court ruled that the NFL had violated that very same Sherman Antitrust Act. And you've said that you would be willing to handle a case against the NFL over the Chargers situation. So can you tell us just a little bit more about your own background and how many antitrust cases you've handled and how many lawsuits against the NFL specifically?
Sure. Well, over the years, I've handled probably dozens of antitrust cases, at least four or five against the NFL. So far, I haven't lost. I first got involved in sports back in the early 1970s in antitrust relating to the Oscar Robertson lawsuit, and since then have brought NHS lawsuits in hockey and football and basketball as well. So far successful.
Very good. So you've got a great winning track record, it sounds like. Now, the city of San Diego, they did really a Herculean job of pulling together a detailed proposal, complete with renderings of a new stadium and a plan to put the funding question on the ballot early next year. James, why do you think the Chargers have refused to negotiate in good faith, given the risk of litigation that they could lose?
Well, because of money. I think that they decided that they think they can make more money in Los Angeles. And the sense I have right now is that they have one foot out the door.
Wow. How much money do you think the city could win if they were to file a suit?
You know, part of it would be depending on whether or not they could get an injunction, which can often be difficult to accomplish. But,
so just an injunction to just halt them from leaving, period, have a judge just say no.
Right, but that could be an uphill battle because it can be a difficult claim to make. On the other hand, if they were ultimately to leave and then the city were to sue the Chargers for damages, it could be in the multi-million dollars.
Now, City Attorney Jan Goldsmith was asked by another media outlet a while back about this very issue, and he said that, first of all, that he prefers right now negotiating rather than litigation, but he also said the city's 2006 lease with the Chargers had a clause that prohibited such litigation. So how would you get around that issue?
Because I've seen that clause. Under the Supreme Court law, you cannot waive a future antitrust violation. So they couldn't waive back in 2006 the violation that was going to occur in 2015. You can't do it under the law. It's against public policy.
Thank you for clarifying that important point. Mark Fabiani, who has headed up the Chargers' effort to find the new stadium, has said in another media interview that a lawsuit would be, quote, meritless because, in his words, no judge will view the city's proposal for a quickie EIR, environmental impact report, is in any way reasonable, and because we've made 9 separate proposals over 14 years to try to find a solution. Can you please comment on that?
Yes, it is a complicated factual situation, but most of what he's saying is irrelevant to what the lawsuit would be about. That is, whether or not the NFL owners have jointly got together to boycott the city of San Diego. So the past history, frankly, is not all that relevant.
So the lawsuit, it sounds like, it could increase the odds of the Chargers putting any moving plans on hold. Is the idea basically to keep them here, or is this more about getting compensation for the city's losses and the loss to fans, however you calculate that, if the Chargers just decide to move anyway?
You know, I think it's more about trying to keep the Chargers here by getting their attention and having them begin to negotiate with the team.
How likely is it that the city would win cases against the Chargers and, for that matter, the NFL for antitrust and violation of the NFL charter also if the city does decide to sue?
The antitrust cases are very complex and they can be lengthy and expensive. So it's difficult always to a clear percentage evaluation, but I would certainly say that the city would have at least a 50-50 chance of being successful.
Well, those are pretty good odds. So if the city does win a lawsuit, can a judge force the Chargers to stay here, or can they just come back and negotiate some more and still find an excuse to leave anyway and just say we did more negotiating and it's still not enough?
That kind of question is, again, very difficult to answer. It would depend on the judge and ultimately what the judge thought, whether or not the Chargers and the league were acting in good faith.
Have there been other cities that have successfully sued, or for that matter, fans anywhere, and forced a team to stay that was trying to bolt and move elsewhere?
You know, the history of that is when you've had situations where, as you recall, the Raiders moved from Oakland to Los Angeles and then back again. There was litigation there. None of it ever came out in a clear-cut way. There's no clear precedent with regard to this kind of lawsuit.
Is there any merit in the Chargers' claim? They're not here today again, but they're claiming the city just didn't do enough and now this is just too little, too late. How would you respond to that?
Again, the antitrust laws are designed to prevent competitors agreeing not to compete, and in this case, agreeing to boycott. And under these circumstances, the past history, too little, too late, is less significant than whether or not they're acting in concert and in violation of the antitrust law.
Okay, so basically it's collusion, in your opinion, that the NFL has engaged in here.
Correct.
So To be a devil's advocate for a moment, not everybody in the town supports building a new stadium. There's a lot of fans that certainly want to keep the Chargers, but there's also people like Councilwoman Emerald, Marty Emerald, who said that she thinks the money might be better spent on things like building more fire stations and fixing potholes. Why should the NFL or the Chargers wait and risk losing the offer in L.A. when the city's proposal hinges on a ballot initiative where fans could vote yes to keep the Chargers and fund a new stadium, but they could also vote no?
Look, if the Chargers really wanted to, you know, act in good faith in San Diego for their entire existence, waiting a year one way or another is not going to, the world's not going to end. I don't see good why point. They wouldn't allow 2 months to go by to see whether or not they can, in fact, get the stadium that they want in San Diego.
Very good point. Now, another important question. The conventional wisdom has been that if the Chargers leave, the NFL itself has basically threatened them and said San Diego would likely never get another pro football team. If the Chargers do move to L.A., would a lawsuit give the city leverage to try to force the NFL to let them keep the Chargers' name and maybe bring another team to San Diego down the road?
Yes, I think it would be significant leverage because the mere fact that the NFL has hinted that if the city doesn't do what they want, they'll be boycotted for forever. In and of itself may violate the antitrust law.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like blackmail, doesn't it? So,
yes.
I'm wondering what else Chargers fans should know about the situation, and is there anything that the fans themselves can do to keep the Chargers in town? What if the city doesn't file a lawsuit? If there's some rich fan out there that really wants to keep the Chargers, could they file their own suit? Or is there anything else they can do?
I just think they have to put the pressure on the politicians. I don't think that a fan lawsuit would have the legs.
And why is that?
Because the fans, secondly, don't have standing under the NHS to bring a kind of lawsuit.
Okay, so because the city spent all the money on all of this and it's the city that would lose the money, then the city has the best standing.
Yes.
Okay. And actually, of course, the fans are also taxpayers, most of them. So maybe, you know, taxpayers bringing pressure on the politicians to say, we want to get our tax dollars worth here. We don't want to see the city take a hit and the losses of our tax dollars would be an influential way to go, perhaps?
Again, I think the critical thing from the fan standpoint is to put pressure on the politicians using whatever pressure they can come up with. The ballot box is usually the most important one to politicians.
Very good point. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today. Listeners, we've been speaking with Jim Quinn, who is an antitrust lawyer in New York City, about the odds of the city filing a lawsuit and perhaps winning a lawsuit to keep the Chargers in town or get money if they leave. I want to thank you so much, and I want to ask, do you have any last words, Jim, that you would like our listeners to know?
Look, I just wish the fans of San Diego good luck in keeping their team.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Jim, for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio.
Take care.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Ed Barreno with East County Magazine's Brew Beat, covering craft beer in East County. And today I am in studio at the East County Wellness Center with a special guest, Kuipu Lawler. And he is a co-founder of the Pacific Islander Beer Company. Kuipu, thanks for being here.
Aloha. Thank you for having us.
I wanted to ask you a few questions about what it takes to start a craft brewery in San Diego.
To open a brewery in California, it takes a ton of paperwork. So it's first, find a location. Once you find a location, that location has to deal with gas and water, the two main things that you're going to need when you open a brewery. Okay. So you'll tend to look at a lot of buildings, but you'll find the building that has the best water flow coming in and the building that has gas. Because in San Diego, back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, SDG&E force a lot of them through rebates to do electric only.
Ah.
Then you, once you have your location, and then you go to the city and you get city approval that that building can be a manufacturing facility. And then once they okay it, then you go to ABC. And that's the California Alcohol Board. And then once they okay you, which is about a couple month process. Then you'll go to TTB, which is a federal licensing. So they're all actually licensing stamps to be able to pay taxes on your beer.
What is the significance of having gas? Is it for heating?
Okay. Gas is really important because, you know, you could do it with electric. It's burners. You need a couple of gas burners, and gas is a lot cheaper than electric.
Okay.
So most of your brew houses are all gas. And then later on, as you get really big, you have to put in boiler rooms, and you're going to have them gas driven versus electric driven.
Interesting. Okay. And so how much work goes into making a batch of beer as far as your materials? Like, I know you guys use barley and hops and water. Like, about how long does it take before you get the product?
Well, when you're looking at a batch of beer, the bigger the batch is, and let's say we're talking about a microbrewery, not a home brewer, but actually the same time that a home brewer makes 5 gallons of beer in the 20 hours that he puts in from start to finish and before drinking, it's about the same amount of time that you can do 60 barrels of beer, which is 120 kegs of beer in a brewery. The time is the same. Now, you're using different products, bigger volume of products when you're talking about your malt, your two-row wheat, your hops, your yeast, any other flavors that you want to add into your fermentation tank after you've gone through the brew house. But when it comes to cost, the size of the brewery totally helps you stay in business versus the smaller the brewery. The smaller the brewery, you're going to put in, you know, 20-hour days between your tasting room and delivering and making beer. And then normally you can't make enough beer. And right now our brewing equipment is on its way from China. So we have a microbrewery system that we can make up to 40 gallons of beer. But then we also contracted with Twisted Manzanita, and they're brewing right now. We start off with 20 barrels each batch and ran out in the first couple weeks. And then we went to 30 barrels, and we still couldn't hold on to our customers because our first 2 weeks, we sold roughly around 45 barrels of beer. So that's 15.5 gallons times 45.
Right.
And then we went to small pours just to try to give everybody a chance to taste it, pulled all our beer back out of the places we put it in. And then now the last batch of the Likey Likey Honey Blonde, we just did a 60-barrel batch. So we got about 100 in, probably 110 kegs out of that batch.
Wow.
And normally that's what happens. When you say a 30-barrel of beer, and that's, you know, 60 kegs.
Okay.
It's 2 kegs per barrel.
15-gallon keg is a half barrel of
beer. So, okay. But you lose in, you know, the whole process. You probably lose, you know, 10 to 12%.
The angel's share, what they call
it. Yeah, you know, or some of it's just the, you know, evaporation. And,
right.
You know, when you're, you know, taking the yeast out and, you know, the hops out, you're losing volume.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
So, you know, let's say you're making 30 barrels of beer and it should be ultimately 60 kegs. It's probably going to be closer to maybe like 55 or 56 if you're really good at it.
Okay. Awesome. You have a Pacific Islander theme. You're Hawaiian. And so I just wanted to find out if there's anything specific about your beer that's different because it's sort of an island style versus a mainland style.
I would think that what our Pacific Islander Beer Company stands for is how we treat people. And that's probably more of who we are, is that we want to share the Islander spirit, not just the Hawaiian Island spirit, but all Pacific Islanders. There's over 20,000 islands that encompass that Pacific Islander realm.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's more of us being that, showing the customer that comes to us
The aloha vibe.
That aloha and that Pacific Island type of spirit. So that when you come in, it's a place that, and even if you took the beer home, it's a comfort to drink the beer and slow down your life and have a good moment. I think most of our beers right now are geared to more what the taste bud is of our industry. Our Honey Blonde to our Dakine or IPA. Towards our double IPA Mobetta, our kind of big joke about Mobetta was a lot of people make great IPA, double IPAs, but we make Mobetta.
Yeah, I had that the other day. It's almost triple IPA in the bitterness realm. It's really, really strong.
It did. We're going to, the next batch we're doing next week, we'll be kegging the kind this week. Our next batch that we'll do of Mobetta, we're going to unfilter it. So unfiltering is going to even bring out more, because when you filter it, it gives it that nice look. Uh-huh. But a lot of your hops and a lot of your, like we use Centennial and a lot of them, sometimes the lesser hops kind of disappear.
Right.
So we're going to switch and so it's going to be a little more. It's not going to be more hoppier. It's just going to be a more full flavor. You know, you're going to drink the beer and you're going to go like, ah, I know that hop. Yeah, I can taste that in there. And most double IPAs today are reverting to that.
Right. I've noticed that. So that, if you see a beer that's very clear, that is most likely filtered.
Sure.
Whereas a nice thick kind of can't quite see through it, that's going to be unfiltered.
Yes. And people think unfiltered because that's kind of like a home brewer.
Homebrewer
was unfiltered. You didn't filter your beer. And so it was a little more cloudier, but people think unfiltered is like, you know, you have chunks in the beer. No, it's still, it's just going to be not as golden or, you know, won't have that color, but it also eliminates a lot of the flavor. So, we kind of talked about it.
I'm excited for that.
And I think it'll be a better, you know.
It'll be Mobetta.
Yeah. There you go. Remember that. Mobetta.
Okay. So, I noticed, there's a few breweries in Santee. It's kind of the hotspot for East County brewing now. And so what are the advantages of doing business over in Santee?
I think our when we first were looking at opening the brewery, my nephew came to me, Will Fox, our head brewer, and he said, you know, I'd like to open a brewery. And so I told him, you know, I'll financially look at it. And me and the wife traveled to probably about 100 breweries all over the place to kind of see what the industry was like. And this is in 2013. And then kind of got a view and I saw the positive and the negative of breweries. So we brought back the positive. At that time, we went to San Diego, the city, and talked to them. We talked to El Cajon about opening a brewery. We talked to Vista, which was very... It would have been really easy to open Vista too,
but we're
all down here in the East County, all but our head brewer who lives in Vista. but everybody else was down here. And so we then met with Santee because, you know, a couple breweries already here. Mm-hmm. And we thought like, you know, go see it. After meeting with them and for 1 hour, we knew, you know, pretty close, this is where we go. We went to a city council meeting because I would suggest that to anybody that wants to open a brewery is go into the city council meeting and introduce yourself to them. Talk about, you got that 3 minutes of time, just like anybody else.
Right.
But, you know, show them that, you know, you want to be a new business and engage how they respond back to you. The city of Santee was outstanding. I mean, they actually made us stay. And then afterwards, we end up talking to them for like, I mean, almost probably another 45 minutes about the brewery, and they were excited. And then once we met with the city council, the governing body, then we met with planning and building, and they were totally excited. They totally kind of like, and it was a year-long process. I mean, if anybody out there that wants to open a brewery or are welcome to come to other breweries. Everybody from Jeff at Twisted Manzanita, Ray at Butchers, and now we have Tom running BNS. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all, you know, we all work together. We all talk. We all check each other's product out. I was just at Twisted Manzanita last night drinking at Chaotic. So, I mean, I go and I support the other breweries. It's not just all about us. It's about our industry, and our industry is not against each other. We're against, you know, the Budweisers and Millers, you know, we're against the people that don't really truly make beer. And that's if you get in the industry, that's what you're after. You're after teaming up. So,
it's good to see,
conquering the gorilla and not, you know, beating us up on the street, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think a lot of industries could take that to heart. And when you have a smaller community of businesses sort of versus that giant Walmart type guy, you know,
totally.
So, that's good to see. That's something I really enjoy about the brewing industry in our county. And then I was going to ask you a little bit about bottling and canning operations. I know that's something that breweries have to sort of take into account. I know you guys probably aren't doing that yet because you opened recently.
Yes. Yeah, we're looking at by the first of the year, we'll be canning. We'll bottle too, but I think our bottling is going to be limited to the brewery. We totally look at a different marketing strategy when it comes to bottling, because bottling is very popular in California, but it's not very popular across the country. A lot of states don't allow you to do bottling. They, you know, there's a different, you know, there's different laws in every state. So canning is the way to go, also because of cost. And cans last longer. Now breweries are, you know, lining cans so that your beer in there, instead of maybe us worrying about it in a couple of months at a liquor store or whatever, you know, you can be 6 months down the road and still that can, and it's got a quality product in it. Cool. You're not worried about the sun beating on it. You're not worried about the weather that it's in. And then the cost. You know, you're able to ship twice as much product of cans versus bottles. So we look at probably getting into the Costco market with cans before we do even anything in a liquor store. I mean, to find us in a liquor store, I would probably say it's not going to happen right now. I mean, it'd be a little ways down the road because of distribution. And another thing, like I was telling you before, we want to treat our customers, and that's from the retailer to the restaurant to the bar to the people that come in our tasting room. We want to treat them like family, and we want to be there for them. We want to promote the product so they build a customer base and that they want to have our product. And today, as you see, I mean, there's major tap hopping and the beer places brand is bouncing all over the place. So if you were a retailer and you were serving our beer for a week or 2 weeks and you had, you know, that 50, 60 customers that came and drank our beer, and then all of a sudden you're gone, it's not doing us any benefit at all.
Right.
It doesn't do me any benefit to have 500 customers out there that buy our beer from us, retailers, and only 100 of them or 50 of them are solid customers. So our goal is to have solid places. So if you go like to Eastbound or you go to all the Boll Weevils, our beer is always going to be on tap.
Nice.
And that's how we're picking off places we want, is that we're going to go in there and help you promote. We're going to do everything we can to get your customers in your retail location so that you have a steady stream of customers drinking our product.
Very nice. That's good. I like seeing that level of involvement. It's not just cash a check and forget it. Very nice. Besides the canning operation, what else do you see in the future for Pacific Islander Beer Company?
I think international sales. I think that that is where everybody's, you know, the smart breweries are going international. The volume's there. The payments there, that's the thing they kind of struggle in the domestic market, getting paid on time. One of the things that we always believe is brand awareness. We buy clothes with brands on them. We buy shoes with brands on them. We buy cars with brands on them. And, and beer is no different. It's not so much, I'm not saying you don't make great beers. You got to make beers that people want to drink.
Of course.
But it's also you want to make great beers that it's a brand that people want to drink. And so a lot of times our whole concept with what we do is to keep pushing our brand and saying that, you know, we totally, I meet with owners in California. We have the CCBA and it's all the owners meet.
Okay.
And so you get a chance to really see, you know, from the Lagunitas's and the Stones and, you know, Walker's Brewery, you know, Firestone
guys.
Walker that just merged, you know, he just sold out. So he's now a bigger craft brewer company, bought them out. But there's a lot of big boys, and you get in there and you get a chance to talk to them. And if you're smart enough, you'd be looking where they're looking instead of looking at just your little pool in your neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah, that's basically where PIB will go. We feel that I want you to be excited about drinking our beer, not just in our brewery, but, you know, at the local restaurant, local retailer.
All right. Very cool. Well, I appreciate you coming in. And they're located at 8665 Argent Street in Suite B, and that's Santee. As always, you got to be 21 to drink beer, and always drive safe if you are consuming alcohol. Yeah. Thanks a lot for being here, Kuipu. And we will see you at the brewery.
We appreciate it. Much mahalo to all you out there.
Thank you very much.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Priebel. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.